that had a cook, caretaker, and gardener, and a maid for each floor. Describing old Charleston's habits, he said, "We do not do these things to impress others. We do them because they have always been done." To which I reply, "Nonsense. What is the point of society but to impress those who can't belong? Charleston was founded by lords and ladies as the home of the only American nobility. It was meant to be a reflection of the English Restoration across the sea. Only here can barons, landgraves, and caciques live on, minus their titles and perhaps their landholdings, but secure in their lineage. They believe in their hearts that theirs is the holy city, set aside for their ancestors and themselves. Nothing like the Charleston aristocracy exists elsewhere in the United States. It ought to be preserved in amber. I suppose, in a way, it is." Aristocrats are generally associated with wealth, but in Charleston, not these days, not necessarily. David Hoffman, who has restored many fine houses, told me about a dowager he knows who was forced to let her servants go, move to her country home, and rent out the old family mansion on Church Street. The new tenant called her to say, "It's a wonderful house, but really the kitchen is a wreck. We have to do something about the kitchen." The owner took a while to absorb this remark. She said, "You went into the kitchen?" Thus, slowly, like everything in Charleston, the old order changes. If you're going to get to know Charleston, what you need are introductions. Most of mine were provided by Jane Kaiser, a tour guide who came to seem like an old friend. She said there was really nothing to her job but chatting and grinning. But I discovered that she knows everybody and everything. For a born and bred Southerner, she lives her life at a disconcertingly fast pace. Thinking back on Jane, I see a blur of blonde hair and hear a sugar-coated Southern accent I accused her of attaining by daily practice before a mirror. "Charles, darling," the voice on the telephone would say, while I was still wiping the sleep out of my eyes, "this is Jane Kaiser." She hardly needed to say her name. She couldn't be anybody else. "Charles," she would say, "I have a marvelous idea for your morning." Even if I had a plan of my own for my morning, I always abandoned it when Jane called. "There's just a marvelous person I want you to meet," she would say. And that's how I met, among others, Gedney Howe III. He is the best-known criminal lawyer in Charleston, successor to his legendary father. Generations of Charlestonians who have been caught in one felonious circumstance or another have known to take their troubles immediately to one Gedney Howe or the other. But as famous as Gedney Howe III may be around the courthouse, it's what he did at the Calhoun House that staggered the town. The Calhoun Mansion at 16 Meeting Street, largest in the city at 24,000 square feet, actually was condemned as a hazardous wreck in 1975. Its portico was caving in and its porches were falling off. Gedney Howe III, less than 2 years out of the University of South Carolina Law School, took a deep breath, found $30,000 for a down payment, and set out to save the building. His father said he wasn't sure he wanted to practice law with a son that crazy. Gedney lived in one room, cooking on a hot plate, for the 2 years it took to patch the roof and shore up the porches. He'd rush down to the court, defend some miscreant, collect a fat fee, and return to pour his earnings into the house on Meeting Street. "The whole house was too much to think about," he said, as he showed Jane and me around. "So I approached it like the truck driver. Somebody said the truck driver drives to Los Angeles. And he said, no, I drive to Birmingham. Then I drive to Cincinnati. Then I drive to Oklahoma City. Then Albuquerque, then Las Vegas. Then from there to Los Angeles. Los Angeles is too far to drive to." "The house," he said, "was too much to restore. I couldn't handle it emotionally. So I did one room at a time, without thinking about the next room." That way, room by room, year by year, He brought the five floors of the great old house back to life, uncovered the fabulous satinwood entryway inlaid with walnut, restored the 14-foot ceilings and the intricate plaster moldings, rebuilt the 75-foot stairwell which ascends to a dome of etched glass, refurnished the dining room to seat 26 in splendor, restocked the library with 19th-century volumes, provided the lavish music room with a gilded harp and piano, combed the world for suitable furniture, gigantic oil paintings, weighty curtain fabrics, and marble statues, and year by year, room by room, created one of the most magnificent houses in America. Being the sharpest criminal lawyer in town helped, at least once. One of his best carpenters shot and killed a relative. Gedney got him acquitted with a plea of self-defense. Then, during a layoff at the house, the same man shot and wounded a policeman in another county. That was a little tougher. Gedney pleaded him insane. The verdict worked out fine. The jury found that the carpenter was insane, but not so insane that he couldn't come back to Charleston and work on the house. After another layoff, Gedney called the man and said, "Okay, we're ready to start on the front bedroom." "I'm sorry, Mr. Howe," the man said. "I'm doing some work for Mr. Johnson." "Come on," Gedney said. "I need you to work on the bedroom." "No, I'm busy with Mr. Johnson right now." "Well, next time you shoot somebody, tell Mr. Johnson to get you off." There was a pause. "Okay, Mr. Howe, I'll be there Monday." The 20-year Calhoun Mansion revival is sublimely complete now, except for a few pieces of statuary its owner still wants to place here and there, and I got the impression that something has gone out of Gedney Howe's life. He doesn't live there. It's no place to bring up children, he said. So it serves as Charleston's gleaming Victorian showplace, the one landmark visitors who see it never forget. The pleasure of the old city is in the details. The cobblestone lanes, so cherished that when the power company had to dig one up, the city required that each cobblestone be numbered for replacement just where it had been. The earthquake bolts that were used to squeeze old buildings back into shape after the quake of 1886. The single houses whose street doors open into airy piazzas. The docking posts on Water Street, dating from the time when the street was a canal. The jasmine and crabapple blooms poking through the iron fences above the Trad Street sidewalk. The sweetgrass basket ladies displaying their woven wares in the shade of the post office on Meeting Street. The statue of John C. Calhoun, that haggard, bitter, fanatical man, defender of slavery, towering on a monumental pedestal above Marion Square. John C. Calhoun, that's what we call old John. I was in the company of Alfonso Brown, band director at Rivers Middle School, black historian and speaker of Gullah, the rich black patois of the Carolina Lowcountry. "White people remember history here," Alfonso said. "Well, we remember it, too. He was Calhoun back then, and he'll be Calhoun 100 years from now." Alfonso told me that as a statue, Calhoun used to be at ground level, but he was so regularly vandalized by black Charlestonians that the Daughters of the Confederacy had to put him up in the sky, out of reach. Alfonso chuckled to think about it. Historically, Charleston was a special hell for black people. As slaves, even more brutally than in most of the rest of the South, they were publicly whipped, branded, and hanged, occasionally gaining a little momentary revenge by poison or arson, which always led, of course, to a new round of frightened white repression. As free citizens, within my own memory, blacks were harassed, segregated, disfranchised, imprisoned without cause, discriminated against in every way the white imagination could devise. A white Charlestonian, U.S. District Judge J. Waties Waring, helped end all that. A member of one of Charleston's oldest and most tradition-bound families, he nevertheless ruled in 1947 that South Carolina's all-white Democratic primary was unconstitutional. And later, well before the U.S. Supreme Court got around to agreeing with him, that racial segregation in the schools was inherently unequal. A cross was burned in front of Judge Waring's house on Meeting Street, and a brick crashed through his window. A former friend, Charleston's Congressman L. Mendel Rivers, called Judge Waring a monster on the floor of the House. The judge was shunned by his own relatives. He was forced to resign from his clubs and even from his church, and finally from the federal bench. He and his wife fled to New York for their safety. I knew Judge Waring during his long exile from his native city, and once I asked him how, considering his background, he had ever arrived at his landmark decisions in the first place. "By being a judge," he said, "I gradually became judicious." He returned to Charleston only to be buried. I was there as a reporter in the Magnolia Cemetery on January 17, 1969, when the funeral cortege arrived at the gravesite. I remember no more than 6 or 8 white faces in the crowd. White Charlestonians, including most members of his family, stayed home that day to show their contempt for him. Hundreds of black people stood there shoulder to shoulder to show their respect. I thought then, and think now, that the judge was an unsung American hero. Perfect racial justice hasn't arrived in Charleston yet, of course, but for what it's worth, a bronze sculpture of J. Waite's Waring now stands in the corner of the City Council meeting room at City Hall. Things have changed. Charleston has a successful black middle class and fair political representation. The police chief, Reuben Greenberg, is black and Jewish, and highly visible as he makes his rounds, sometimes in a squad car, sometimes on roller skates or on horseback. Black deference to whites, once taken for granted, exists only in the memory of old folks. A black woman friend of Jane Kaiser's said, "I'm not picking any more cotton, honey. I don't even pick the cotton out of the aspirin bottle." In 1900, the Baedeker Guide to the United States listed 3 must-see attractions: the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, and Charleston's Magnolia Gardens. Maybe because I'm a sucker for 300-year-old live oak trees hung with Spanish moss, and for azaleas and camellias and dogwoods, and for Cherokee roses growing on fences, I think I'd put Magnolia Gardens first on that list. I am a sucker for eccentrics, too, and Drayton Hastie, who showed me around Magnolia Gardens, enjoys this distinction. He barred bulldozers from his grounds after the havoc of Hurricane Hugo, and instead, to the incredulity of his neighbors, hired a helicopter for 6 months at $1,000 an hour to lift trees back into place and haul away wreckage. Mr. Hastie, pushing 80, wore a tie and a fine tweed jacket, and strolled the grounds as master of the manor with 2 dogs on a leash. I had to walk fast to keep up with him. "This formal garden," he said, "was planted by my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, Anne Fox Drayton, in 1676. He walked on a few steps before adding matter-of-factly, "which makes this the oldest garden in the Western Hemisphere." Mr. Hastie has disposed of his house in town. "I don't have much to do with Charleston people," he said. "They all talk about this place, but they never come out here. I get along very well without them." I found Mr. Hastie's antisocial streak appealing. It started early. He nodded toward a tall cypress tree growing in the middle of his swamp. "I built a treehouse in that cypress 70 years ago," he said. "I used to paddle my little boat over there and get away from it all. The treehouse is gone, as you can see. I often wish it were still there." The family tomb, established in the 1600s, stands on a knoll above the river. Out of curiosity, Mr. Hastie once found the hidden entrance and entered. He found the caskets disintegrated and such a jumble of skulls and bones littering the floor that he started trying to think of a more seemly resting place for his own ashes. One day it came to him, the treehouse solution. He pointed to a neat hole drilled about 50 feet overhead in the trunk of a spreading live oak. "That's where I'm going," he said. Drayton Hastie's gardens were my greatest Charleston pleasure, except for Drayton Hastie's company. I think he enjoyed my company, too. He wrote me a note and had it delivered to my little house on Montague Street. "Sorry we had so little time with you, but perhaps you will return." Perhaps I will. I hope so. I hope it is in March when Charleston is in her glory. I hope things will not have changed too much. I hope the hole in that live oak at Magnolia Gardens is still unfilled. I hope a mockingbird is singing. April, a change of plans. A butterfly changed my plans for April. I didn't even see the butterfly. He was in New Zealand to begin with, a place I've never been, and it was in November 1983, a long time before I had any plans for April, 12 years later, that this faraway butterfly changed them. That's the way life goes, of course. A breeze comes up in Rhode Island on a morning in March during the Civil War, and a Union soldier home on leave goes into a park in Providence to fly a kite, and a young woman sees the kite in the sky from her front stoop a block away and wanders into the park, where she meets the soldier and likes him, and they write letters to each other after he goes back to his outfit, and they're married after the war, and they have a son who grows up and has a son, who grows up and has a son who is named Charles after the soldier. And here I am. But I wouldn't be if a Rhode Island day in 1864 had turned out calm rather than breezy. I owe everything to the wind and to Providence. I had planned to go to California's Monterey Peninsula in April, and except for that New Zealand butterfly, I would have. I had it all figured out. I was going to drive up the coast road to Big Sur and park myself in a hideaway room at the Ventana Inn with a fireplace and a balcony and a 50-mile view of the mountains and the ocean and stay there until my money ran out, which at the Ventana wouldn't have taken long at all. I'd have gone to Pacific Grove, too. April is when the monarch butterflies, a couple of million of them, take flight from Pacific Grove. I once saw thousands of monarchs rise into the air there, flutter for a moment to get their bearings, and form into a bright, wavering, golden thread a mile long, northward bound across the blue waters of Monterey Bay. The monarchs are the greatest mystery of nature, if you ask me. They spend the winter in Pacific Grove, then fly as far as 2,000 miles into Canada to spend the summer. There they breed and die, but their offspring return to Pacific Grove each fall, to the same forest, to the very same trees. The migration of salmon and geese and hummingbirds is amazing enough, but at least we can imagine their being guided along familiar paths by the ocean currents, or the terrain, or the stars. Monarch butterflies also know exactly where they are going. However, it is to a place they've never been. How do they do it? Human beings have no idea. We outweigh monarchs, but they outsmart us. They know something we don't. But I didn't see the Pacific Grove monarchs because that other butterfly, the New Zealand one, changed my plans. This is going to require a little explanation, and I need to make a running start. I have a friend, Granville Hall, who raises daffodils in Gloucester, Virginia. I feel lucky if I see him once every 10 years, but he's the sort of man who doesn't let time and distance impede friendship. Nearly every summer, he sends me a box of daffodil bulbs, old standbys and new hybrids, and I dutifully plant them in the fall in a grove of Connecticut maple trees, which I've come to think of as Granville's Woods. I look forward to the October ritual. I take a sturdy bulb planter and a big bag of the right kind of fertilizer from the shed, and twist the 12-month stiffness out of my gardening gloves, and spend a day or two filling in patches of ground where I haven't planted Granville's bulbs in years past. There is satisfaction in this. The bulbs don't need much attention from year to year, and that forest floor has become a pretty good daffodil show in the spring. But I have not always been able to be there in the spring to enjoy it. One year, CBS News sent me off to Moscow in April for a summit conference, and another year to Beijing in the peak daffodil weeks. One of the frustrations of my job was not being able to say, "I'm sorry, I can't cover this cosmic event on the other side of the world, because I have to go watch my daffodils bloom." Well, now I didn't have a job anymore. I was free to go watch my daffodils bloom, which, come to think of it, is everybody's reason for retiring, to take time to smell the flowers. And here I was, still driven by this immutable, rambling habit of mine, planning on my own to be on the other side of the continent in daffodil season. Suddenly, the Monterey Peninsula didn't seem quite so crucial to my perfect year. In a perfect year, you ought to be free to change your mind. Besides, Granville Hall had paid me a considerable compliment the previous fall. Into his annual shipment of daffodil bulbs, large yellow trumpets and double whites and Tazetta hybrids, each labeled by name, he had tucked a paper bag sealed with staples containing two bulbs he obviously meant to be special. When I opened the bag, a label fell out. It said, "Narcissus Charles Kuralt." It took me a few minutes to realize it wasn't a joke. Granville had named a daffodil for me. In a letter which came later, he said that in all his years breeding daffodils, this was the first cultivar he had ever registered. He sent along the certificate from the Royal Horticultural Society. He said he had raised the bulb from seed and had named it in honor of my impending retirement. In all the world, he said, there now existed just three Charles Kuralt daffodil bulbs. He wanted me to have two of them. I had planted those two bulbs with special care in a pretty place, on a slope above a mill pond. They had been there gathering strength all winter. I calculated that their first shoots would appear toward the end of March, and that they should bloom in the third or fourth week of April. Narcissus, you know, was a youth who pined away in love for his own image in a pool of water, and was turned into a flower. Now that Granville Hall had turned me into a flower, a wave of narcissism washed over me. I wanted to see myself as a daffodil. I decided Monterey Bay would still be there next year. It was a lovely April in New York. I had acquired a writing room atop a building in Midtown Manhattan and fixed it up with mahogany shelves and cabinets, shutters at the windows, and oriental rugs on the floor. I installed the desk and chair I'd bought in New Orleans, and arranged everything to resemble the library of a very small and down-at-the-heels men's club, just the effect I wanted. Now I went there to comport myself as a gentleman of leisure, to read at my desk when I wanted, and to type up my travel notes at an outdoor table on the planted terrace. I thought of this as reflection and meditation. Once upon a time I would have called it goofing off. I realized I was playing a role, but it was a role I was beginning to enjoy. All the time, I was waiting for my daffodil to bloom. I knew a lot of hard work and good luck went into breeding a new daffodil, but I had no idea how much time and patience went into it until I asked Granville Hall to tell me the details, and he responded with a letter from Gloucester. That's when I found out about the New Zealand butterfly. Most of the daffodil varieties on file with the International Daffodil Registrar in London are the result of careful hybridizing, applying the pollen of one showstopper bloom to the stigma of another, and keeping careful records of this cross-pollination for the 5 or 6 years it takes for a tiny seed to become a blooming bulb. But as a flower, my own birth was unplanned, As we used to say down home in North Carolina, I was a love child. Granville wrote, I wish I could tell you that Narcissus Charles Kiralt is the product of years of brilliant and strategic cross-pollination by a master of the trade. Tain't so. Your lovely namesake was conceived by a butterfly, or by an ant, or spider, or naive bee, or by the wind, among the plantings of Phil Phillips at Otorohanga, New Zealand. The happy accident occurred in November of 1983. Phil Phillips, now deceased, was a world-famous hybridizer of down-under daffodils, and a generous man to boot. Each spring, which ends in December down there, he would gather open, naturally, pollinated seeds from his faded blooms and send them to Dr. William Bender of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Bender nicknamed these shiny little black birdshots Pops, Phillips' Open Pollinated Seed, and equally generously offered them to others. Narcissus Charles Kiralt was among some 1,500 pops I acquired from Dr. Bender and planted in the spring of 1984. Incidentally, Granville wrote to me, you will find that Narcissus Charles Kiralt looks a great deal like Pop's Legacy, with which Dr. Bender won Best Bloom in Show at the National Show in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. No small potato, that. After they'd been 2 years in the seedbed, Granville wrote, I transplanted all surviving seed, some don't germinate, to a regular row in my production field, where Narcissus Charles Kiralt first bloomed in 1990. It caught my eye in the spring of 92, whereupon I dug it in June and planted it in the fall in a tender loving care bed in my side yard. An enthusiastic comment last March by my neighbor and resident expert inspired me to register it. So, as a flower, I was the child of an unnamed mother and an unknown father, conceived in New Zealand, bred in Tidewater, Virginia, and now a resident of Connecticut. I was dying to know what I looked like. The possibilities, of course, were astronomical. Granville had told me that professional breeders who cross daffodil genes don't always or even usually obtain a pretty flower. So, what could a butterfly, or ant, or bee, or spider have accomplished by chance? So I didn't go to California. I did some reading and writing and relaxing, and then I went to Connecticut. I was there on the morning the first Narcissus Charles Kiralt opened to the world. Some daffodils are showy and assertive. Some are pert. This one was delicate and refined. From the midst of its creamy white petals arose a trumpet of pale yellow with a feathery lemon-yellow fringe. The flower faced the sun demurely, but with what I thought was a certain confidence. Well, it seemed to say, here I am. What do you think? I thought it was beautiful, and not quite like any other daffodil I'd ever seen. Each bulb yielded two blooms. Each of the four flowers was perfect. Several times each day I walked to the knoll where they were growing to make sure they were all right. When I had to return to New York, I cut them and drove them home with me. They rode in a glass of water wedged into the passenger seat. I stopped for gas at a place where they still clean your windshield, and the guy said, "Nice flowers." I wanted to tell him the whole story, of course, but all I said was, "Thanks." When you leave your job after a long time in the public eye, everybody wants to have a dinner and give you a plaque or a scroll. Such dinners were given for me during the year by organizations I admire. My old university put my name on a building. This was all very heady stuff. But I didn't know what narcissism was until I beheld my own Narcissus. Plaques tarnish. Scrolls fade, but those daffodil bulbs will divide and multiply. Within a year or two, I'll be able to give a couple of bulbs to each of my daughters. If they plant them and care for them, those will divide in turn and yield bulbs for my grandchildren. With a little luck, the flower named Charles Kiralt will appear from the earth to bloom in the spring long years after the man of the same name is gone. I guess that's not exactly immortality, but it's as close as I will ever get. May, Grandfather Mountain, North Carolina. The temperature dropped 30 degrees as I drove up into the North Carolina mountains. It was a 94-degree afternoon down at Lenoir. Half an hour later, when I turned left onto the Blue Ridge Parkway at Boone, a storm was blowing up, and the temperature gadget on the dashboard of the rental car told me it was 63 degrees outside. I turned off the air conditioner, opened the car window, and let a great rush of cool mountain air wash over me. I felt that I was home. I've always felt at home in the mountains. I don't know why. I was born in Wilmington on the flat coast way at the other end of the state and brought up in the rolling Piedmont near Charlotte, which passed at the time for a big city. I get no particular tingle in either place. I feel embraced by the mountains. The parkway which follows the ridges was fog-bound that afternoon. I turned on my headlights and went slow. It would have been easy to make a wrong turn in the fog, and you don't want to make a wrong turn on the Blue Ridge Parkway. There are places where you could whistle two choruses of Barbara Allen in the air before you landed down in the valley. I was headed for Hugh Morton's Mountain. He's the only man I know who owns one, Grandfather Mountain above Linville, so named because if you look at it the right way from the back side, it has the aspect of an old man staring up into the sky. The top of Grandfather is the highest point in the Blue Ridge, a little short of 6,000 feet. On a clear day, you feel that you can see the whole world from up there. In fact, long before any road wider than an Indian footpath led to Grandfather, the great French naturalist André Michaud climbed to the top. This was in 1794, 5 years after the French Revolution. And Michaud, thinking he was standing on the highest peak in North America, sang the Marseillaise up there and shouted, "Long live the Republic of France, and long live the United States of America." Part of his excitement, no doubt, was that he had been finding botanical species he'd never seen before or imagined. He couldn't have known it then, but from the top of Grandfather Mountain, his eyes were falling upon a greater variety of trees and plant life than exists in all of Europe, from the Scandinavian capes to the Mediterranean Sea. Grandfather Mountain is a special place in the world, designated by the United Nations as an international biosphere reserve, the only privately owned one in the world. I wasn't thinking about any of this on my drive toward Grandfather. I was squinting into the white mist and thinking about keeping the car on the road. A wild turkey appeared in the vapor ahead of me, glided across the parkway, and disappeared on the downhill slope as I went by. A bushy critter, maybe a woodchuck, started across the road, thought better of it, and lumbered back into the bushes. I met no other cars. I felt alone in the cool white world with the creatures of the forest. A great happiness came over me. Hugh Morton was letting me use a secluded one-room cabin he and his brother built on an anvil-shaped ledge of the mountain. When I got there, the coffee pot was on the stove, the refrigerator was stocked with orange juice and milk, and somebody, dear Julia Morton, I imagine, had arranged two beautiful pink rhododendron blossoms in a vase on a window-side table. I carried my bags in just before the first raindrops spattered on the roof. I lighted a fire in the huge stone fireplace that occupied one end of the room and sat down before the fire to listen to the gathering storm. Only a bumblebee buzzing around my head was out of place. Or maybe he was in place and I was out. He liked the rhododendron blossoms, too. It was raining, and the night was coming on. I figured the bee and I could coexist until morning. A big wind built in intensity all night. I woke up to the roar of it and felt the cabin shuddering. I was elated by the storm. Don't ask me why. I rolled over and went contentedly back to sleep, feeling privileged to be there, safe and warm and dry. At first light, I could look down into the Linville Valley from my snug aerie and see the tops of small trees bending nearly to the ground in the gusts. and when I stepped out to drive down the mountain to buy the morning papers in Linville, the light rain blowing horizontally stung my cheeks. By the time I returned and had a big bowl of cereal and a cup or two of coffee, the wind was dying down, and the wild sky was beginning to show patches of blue. An hour later, the sun was out, and the world felt washed and fresh and new. I went out to have a walk around. The cabin was anchored on the lip of a 1,000-foot gorge, no walking that way. Deep woods extended along the cliffside almost to my front door. At the fringe of the forest, a patch of bluets grew, still moist from the rain. Of all the wildflowers, I think bluets are my favorites. A baby rabbit hopped out of the woods. He settled himself amid the flowers as I walked around, in the naive belief of rabbits that they become invisible if they stay perfectly still. In fact, any passing hawk could have spotted him easily in his bed of bluets, but none did. When I left the cabin 3 weeks later, the rabbit was still nibbling the grass around the edge of the woods, and the flower patch was still his favorite resting place. I spent most of that day sitting on the cabin steps, gazing out over the valley to the mountains, inventing reasons not to go anywhere or do anything. I got out my binoculars and tried to spot a woodpecker who was hammering on a tree part of the way down into the gorge. How do woodpeckers manage always to stay on the other side of the tree? I watched a pair of ravens circling in an updraft, apparently just for the fun of it. I've heard that ravens are the most playful as well as the smartest of birds. These two found a thermal they liked and rose higher and higher overhead until they were two tiny dots against the sky. In late afternoon, I listened to birds singing in the hills above me and in the valley below. I can't identify many birds by their calls. One of the gaps in my knowledge I want to correct someday. I'd rather know bird songs than know French. I hadn't come to the mountains just to gaze at the flowers and listen to the birds as much as I was enjoying both. What I really wanted to do was meet a few people and hear a few stories. I spent all those years in television making a living by talking. I knew that in the North Carolina mountains, the pleasure is in listening. Nearly everybody in the Blue Ridge can tell you a story. North Carolina mountain people are the best storytellers in the world. The old Scots-Irish language and dialect survive in the mountain hollows, and the easy, brilliant 17th-century way of telling tales. They are almost always tales of old times. I think back now to some of the stories I heard in my mountain month of May. My friend Dr. Ted Ledford, with whom I've gone trout fishing in the mountain streams in springtimes gone by, was born and raised in that Shakespearean tradition of mountain storytelling. Now he teaches Shakespeare at Lees McRae College. He told me this one. "I knew a man," Ted said, "who got into a quarrel with a friend in a timber camp. One night his friend shot him in the face as he came into the mess hall. The bullet knocked out two of his front teeth and lodged in his head above his palate. He used to put chewing gum over the hole so he could drink without having his beer coming out his nose. 40 years later, sitting on his porch in Bakersville, he sneezed the bullet into his hand. People always said someday those two will meet again and the quarrel will be settled one way or another. The years went by. Finally, it happened. They met on the street in Bakersville. The people around them all held their breath. What happened?" I asked. "Well," Ted said, "the two of them just stood there. Neither one knew what to do." He thought about it for a while, the way good storytellers do, to let me think about it. And then, well, they hugged each other. They talked a while and went on their way. It was over. I thought it was a terrific story. Shakespeare isn't around to make a play out of it, so I guess Ted Ledford will write it himself someday. Hal McClure is a mountain woodcarver with a great drooping mustache. I think it might be worth the trouble of growing a mustache if I could have one like that before I die. While Hal worked on an owl head letter opener with wood shavings all over his chest, he told me stories. He said, I come from a long line of carvers and coopers and cabinet makers. This is the truth, he said. Instead of a pacifier, I cut my teeth on a pocket knife my mama gave me. Her mother was a good carver, and she was a good carver. I had great-grandfathers who fought in the Revolution. A lot of them went west. I've been told the Platte River was named after my great-great-great-uncle. My granddaddy met Davy Crockett. Said Davy was about 5'5" or 5'6", red-headed and red-bearded and mean as a striped snake. That's exactly what he said. My granddaddy said Davy lay around drinking whiskey and fighting. That's all he done. There are many good reasons to spend the month of May in the Blue Ridge, and listening to the good talk is one of the best. We aren't inhibited in our talk, North Carolina's Roy Wilder Jr. once wrote. We turn the spigot and let it burble. The Southern Appalachian chain used to serve as a barrier to flatlanders from elsewhere, leaving the mountaineers isolated to talk their own language, brew their own whiskey, and live their own lives. Now things are changing, and not in a way that any mountain dweller likes. The natural blue haze that gave the Blue Ridge Mountains their name is getting thicker and grayer. The winds from the west are no respecters of the geographical barrier. Chemicals from smokestacks in Michigan and Ohio fall on the mountains in acid rain, and once beautiful stands of Fraser fir and red spruce now stand dead on the tops of the ridges. A scientist tested the soil atop Mount Mitchell, highest point east of the Rockies, and found its acidity to be halfway between that of lemon juice and battery acid. An even more noticeable change is in the nature of the population. The only way to get to Boone, it used to be said, is to be born there. But the highway builders have been at work, and outsiders escaping the heat of Florida and South Carolina now flock to the North Carolina high country in the summer. They barricade themselves behind locked gates in their houses and condominiums. Most of them care a lot about their bridge hands and golf scores, and nothing at all about the life and traditions of the mountain people. The newcomers have money, of course, as hardly any of the old-time residents have, and this causes a strain. The Watauga Democrats' local correspondent, TLC, wrote from Sugar Grove, "We need to take pride in ourselves and our way of life. Ain't a soul the good Lord made that is any better than the rest." She said she and her husband saw five men in expensive outfits taking fly fishing lessons in a meadow, casting their lines onto the grass. She said this scene caused her husband to remark, "The end of time is coming fast." It was a strange sight to behold, she wrote. Let's all remember, as the tourist season again falls upon us, to be as pleasant as possible. But keep your backbone straight and strong, for we in our mountains will be here after they are gone. In the same paper, an old-time country store which used to deal in crosscut saws and chicken feed and lamp oil advertised two new coffee bean flavors, Chocolate Cherry Kiss and Chocolate Streusel. The end of time is coming fast. But for all the changes, the mountains are still beautiful, as beautiful as any place on earth, I think, and they still have a strong pull on those born in their folds. Ted Ledford told me, mountaineers have a sense of place, a sense of home. We say never move so far away that you can't see the smoke from your parents' chimney. Ted Ledford is in the hills to stay. I think he renews his vows every year in the spring. I'm an outdoor man, he said, and the winters are right hard on me. I watch that sun every day. I know right where it's going to be on December 21st, and I watch it start back up. By this time of year, whatever worries I had in the winter are all gone and forgotten. I'm a new man in May. In the cold winters Ted dreads so much, sometimes there's only so much to do after you tend to the fire and the hearth. I think it was Ted who told me about a man who came down the hill to visit the clinic in Banner Elk one winter. The doctor asked, "Are you sleeping all right?" The man said, "Well, I'm sleeping all right at night, and I'm sleeping pretty well in the morning, but here lately I've been having trouble getting to sleep in the afternoon." Hugh and Julia Morton's daughter Catherine, who lives near Grandfather Mountain and pays close attention to the subtleties of solstice and equinox, calculates that spring comes up the mountains at 200 feet per day. So now, in the middle of May, I began to see some of the same blooms I saw in Charleston at the beginning of March. A dogwood behind my cabin transformed itself from pale yellow to brilliant white in the space of a week. I took the chill from the nights with crackling fires in my fireplace and welcomed the refreshing mornings. As one who has always been willing to go to any latitude or altitude to escape hot weather, I could be secure in the knowledge that real summertime never quite makes it to the high country. The warmest temperature ever recorded on Grandfather Mountain was 82 degrees in a still-remembered long-ago heat wave. With spring in bloom, visitors arrived at Grandfather in greater numbers. They pay a fee at the gate and spend the day in a place of great natural beauty, hiking, picnicking, daring one another to walk across Hugh Morton's mile-high swinging bridge, and admiring the black bears and cougars in the spacious animal habitats on one of the mountain slopes. I made the acquaintance of one of these visitors when Hugh took me into the bear enclosure to see some of the animals up close. John Derrich works for the post office in Commack, Long Island. One day in 1990, I was a typical postal worker, he said, reading somebody else's mail. One day in 1990, he was thumbing through a copy of Natural History magazine and came across a story about bears. Something clicked in John's brain. He remembered the time when he was a kid and the animal trainer for the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus let him stand outside a fence a couple of feet from the bears. The thrill of it came back to him. He resolved to spend the rest of his life as close as he could to bears. John went to Minnesota in the dead of winter and talked the Forest Service's Dr. Lynn Rogers into letting him tag along on a trip into bear country. He went to Montana to travel the wilderness with another expert, Charles Junkel of the Great Bear Foundation, on the trail of grizzlies. Now John saves all his vacations for bear trips. He comes to Grandfather Mountain three or four times a year to visit a hulking four-year-old female black bear named Jerry. He has special permission to enter the enclosure. He was walking around looking for Jerry when Hugh and I came through the gate. "Will Jerry remember you?" I asked John. "I think she will. I feel she will," he said. "I always bring her shelled sunflower seeds. I think she remembers. I think she'll be glad to see me." Jerry appeared from behind a boulder, looking enormous. I took a few steps back. John Derrich walked right up to the massive animal. He said, "Hi, Jerry." The bear keeper was in the enclosure, a can of pepper spray in his hand for protection. "Don't try to pet that bear," he commanded. "That bear cannot be petted, no how." Jerry walked up and nuzzled John Derrich. "Careful, careful," the keeper said. John sat down on the ground. Jerry sat down, too. John started rubbing her belly. Jerry rolled over on her back with what I thought was a kind of bear smile. "All bears like marshmallows and apples and cookies," John said, "but Jerry is nuts about shelled sunflower seeds." He fed her sunflower seeds from a paper sack with one hand and kept rubbing her belly with the other. I leaned on a rock and talked with John while he and Jerry had their reunion. "Yeah, Jerry remembers me," he said. "She knows me." The thrill of being remembered was written all over his face. "I'll tell you," he said, "when I'm with Jerry, I just have a feeling about myself that I never had before I got interested in bears. It's the feeling that I've done something with my life, something almost nobody else has done." He unlimbered his camera and made a few photographs of Jerry, whisker-length close-ups. He said, "I'm known at the post office as the Bear Man now. The kids in the neighborhood call me the Bear Man. At the place where I process my film, they have some of my pictures blown up on the wall, and when I walk in, the guy always says to whoever else is in there that I'm the Bear Man, the one who made the pictures." I felt John's enthusiasm and found myself admiring him for his passion. He told me he has accumulated 150 books on bears. He saves up for his bear trips, waiting for the low airfares. He gets his job done at the post office, but bears have taken over all his spare time. Most people never find a burning purpose in life. Maybe it wouldn't have happened to John Darich if he hadn't been reading somebody else's mail that day. I left John and Jerry and walked up the hill for lunch. Lunch in the mountains for me was almost always a barbecue sandwich. I've spent a good part of my life looking for the perfect barbecue. There's no point in looking in places like Texas, where they put some kind of ketchup on beef and call it barbecue. Barbecue is pork, which narrows the search to the South. And if it's really good pork barbecue you're looking for, to North Carolina. Barbecue is one of three highly subjective subjects in North Carolina, the other two being politics and religion. Some people prefer their barbecue chopped, some sliced, some shredded. Catherine Morton and I drove all the way to Pinola just because she likes the sliced barbecue at the Mountaintop Restaurant. I tried the barbecue at Hampton's Country Store in Linville and the Smokehouse outside of Newland and the Woodlands in Blowing Rock and a number of other places. I liked the odd savory cubes of barbecue they serve between two slices of white toast at Pappy's on the Linville Boone Road. But if you ever buy a barbecue sandwich from Pappy's, don't try to eat it while driving. You'll end up with sloppy brown cubes all over your lap. And Pappy's barbecue sauce is abiding. It doesn't all come out in the wash. I hate to admit it, but the best barbecue I had in the mountains was at the little cafeteria at the Nature Museum on Grandfather Mountain, which buys it from somebody else. It was the genuine shredded item of the whole hog variety, served in a soft hamburger roll with the usual barbecue accompaniments, sweet iced tea, Brunswick stew, cornbread, and coleslaw. I like a few drops of Texas Pete hot sauce on my barbecue to heat it up, and then I like to put the coleslaw right in the sandwich to cool it down. Not everybody agrees. I have a friend who says Senator Jesse Helms is God's retribution to North Carolinians for eating coleslaw on their barbecue. Out of habit or out of necessity, a few mountain people still roam the woods collecting plants and digging roots for sale. Some of them are old enough to remember a time when there were no doctors, so families doctored themselves with the medicinal plants they found growing wild. This lore lives on in many a mountain cabin. Ora Watson shared some of her healing knowledge with me. She said if you're sick to the stomach, go to a swamp and find some boneset blossoms. Dry them good and make a tea. It's bitter as quinine, but it cures the stomach flu and the gout, and I think some other things. Aura's husband Willard remembered some cures too, but Willard never tells you anything without adding a story. He said Henry Parsons' wife used to use red-stemmed ivy to make ooze. Ooze, I asked. That's what she called it, Willard said. It was a poultice for Henry's arthritis, but he couldn't stand the burning. I was there when his wife asked him, "Can I do anything for you, Henry?" He said, "Next time I pass by you, just throw a bucket of cold water on me." Willard and Aura have lived in the same spot on Wildcat Road in Deep Gap since they were married 68 years ago, and Willard 20 years longer than that since he was born. Except that there was no Wildcat Road back then, only a footpath. Willard had to walk in and out of the hollow to school, to the store, and when he started work, to work. For years, he said, I walked 6 miles to the sawmill and 6 miles back for $2 a day. Aura said, I remember seeing you come over that hill from the mill carrying a 100-pound bag of chop, food for the hogs. You hauled it on your shoulder all the way. As an old moonshiner, Willard is partial to cures flavored with corn whiskey, dry pokeberries in corn whiskey with sulfur for arthritis, camphor with corn whiskey for pneumonia. That cured Sally, he said, and she's still living. For yellow jaundice, Aura said, you need to parch rye and grind it up to make tea. That